The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to journalist Tony Doris. He's just published his first novel, Dirt, and it is one funny, only in South Florida, parcel of real estate craziness. Stick around. Tony's not just a guest. He's the official spokesjournalist for the entire Mr. Media Network. Well, at least he would be, if we could afford a network. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of Miami realtors, politicians, and journalists worried that any similarities between themselves and characters in Dirt by Tony Doris may not be blurred enough to hide their actual misdeeds and knucklehead on a stickiness in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Hundreds of novelists have paraded through this show over the last 8 years to promote their works of fiction, and many of them were first-timers. But Tony Doris is the only one I personally nudged to pull his first novel out of a dusty drawer and publish it. Not only that, Dirt is the first fictional property I've published under the Mr. Media Books banner. Now, Tony and I have been friends for almost 30 years, boy-year-old, and I have always thought he was a terrific writer. He sees the world through a lens with its filter, you know, askew, even when his work as a journalist took him through the most serious topics. His friends knew he would always find the subtle humor in anything he touched. So when he wrote his first novel during late nights and weekends while working his day job as a reporter and editor at the Palm Beach Post, I was frustrated that no traditional publisher bid at it. But in this day of e-books, I didn't believe a work as witty, insightful, and clever as Dirt should stay in a drawer. So I cajoled my buddy to dust it off and let me publish it. If you like the work of Miami's better-known journalists turned novelists, such as Carl Hiaasen and Dave Barry, and even the late Elmore Leonard, I think you'll dig Dirt. And if you're in politics or the real estate or journalism business, you'll probably encounter a lot of familiar people, I mean industry types, in the book. Tony Doris, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for that introduction.
You're welcome. And folks, does this guy not look like Andy Garcia or what? I'm telling you. Anyway, Tony, congratulations on Dirt.
Sorry, who are you again?
Oh, go screw yourself. first guest I've told that to. Yeah, you got to know there's some history there. So, Tony, so many journalists want to write a novel, but you actually did it. Why? I mean, how did you compel yourself to get it done?
Well, I'm one of those folks who waited a long time before getting around to doing something that he really wanted to do all along. Journalism is a trade, a craft, but, in your heart, sometimes you want to do other things. But, you know, it's always a little bit hard to take the leap. And, one thing that kept in mind is that, you know, Herman Melville didn't write Moby Dick till he was 45. And then suddenly that time was getting close, and then it was going by. And so that's what made me do it and made me get off my duff. It's hard when you got a day job, I tell you. But I had some commuting time in the morning on the way to work that helped me get it started. So.
Wait. You were typing while you were driving?
No, on the train, fortunately.
Oh, okay. All right.
That was before the texting days.
So you actually had free time. So you.
Yeah, with a pen and a pad. Actually started with pencils and pens.
Wow, you are an old world guy. What were you, born in the 20th century?
Yeah, I actually drew an outline.
Oh, no.
Roman numeral.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, what was the hardest part about doing it for a guy who was used to journalism and daily deadlines? Or was that actually good training?
That was great training for it because I always took my journalism as when I was writing, I was always trying to pay attention to the five senses, you know, not just do an AP-style matter-of-fact thing. I was always trying to look for the humanity in it, the smell of it, the touch of it, the taste of it, make it like a novel. But the most frustrating thing was always never having the time to give it the justice. So I ended up writing this in bits and pieces and just stealing time here and there from everything I could to put it together. But, you know, when you have a day job, like I say, it's hard. But also the day job gives you all the ideas and just puts you in the real world and tells you all the details about how things work. So, you know, you have to have lived a little bit to have something to tell a story about. So,
you know, I think that's the biggest part. I know in my own work, it took me years before I felt comfortable attempting fiction because I just felt like I don't have anything to write about. I mean, you hear about these guys who are in their teens or their 20s, men and women who are in their teens or their 20s, and they start writing fiction, and they have great insights. But I just kind of felt like until I was in my 40s that I just didn't have – I mean, I had to stick to journalism, really, because I didn't really have, something to say, a view on things.
You know, different skills come at different times. There are some people who are really driven when they're younger, but they haven't had the experience at the writing, and yet other people – are able to write really well when they're young, but they don't have the perspective. So it's it's a blend. I felt I was finally ready. So
you felt that the daily deadline business was good for you because you're used to writing a certain amount of words a day. You organize. Is that it, or is there something else?
Well, that's part of it, but mainly, as a journalist, you're a jack of all trades. You know, in Miami, I was focusing on the real estate industry and business and law, and those are all the things that combined to kind of rule the city. And that's the only way you can learn about it. You know, fiction, you can imagine fiction as something that you're completely imagining from top to bottom. But in fact, the thing that gives it more bite is when you've got some reality to cling to, when you take the reality and bend it instead of trying to imagine what reality might be.
Would it be fair to describe this book as a bit of a Romana Clef?
Sure, I guess you could call it that. It talks a little bit, it takes pieces of my life, it takes pieces of the life of the city. But again, no one in real life is exactly depicted in any way. It's all just, as I said, took it and twisted it and bent it. My daughter said to me the other day, "Oh, I read this, your character is this girl who sounds just like me." And I said, "Yeah. Except for one thing, you're 18, and when I started writing this, you were only 8. So you know, if you take something and imagine into the future, imagine into the past, it's kind of one of the fun things about writing. It's, you travel through time a little bit.
Well, it's funny that your daughter, who of course I know, has kind of wondered if that was sort of her there. I thought the same thing, frankly, even knowing how long it had taken you to write the book and then to get it published. But the thing I also felt is in reading sort of the hero of the book, or the protagonist of the book, Charlie Harrington, that to me, that has Tony Doris all over the voice of that when he's speaking.
Except again, yeah. In the book, he's very farther advanced, more than I was as a journalist. You know, when I first started this thing, as you said, I'd been writing this over a period of years, I think maybe it's time to explain a little bit about how the plot works so people have a sense of it. Basically, it's the story of a tired, neglected journalist who, you know, the public loves him. They've been reading him for years. But his editors are, a little bit, tired of dealing with old Charlie when they've got all their minimum wage reporters that they can push around a lot more. So Charlie's writing his columns, and he's always in the background. But one day his daughter gets an internship at the newspaper doing all the scut work. And as she's doing her scut work, she gets a chance one day to fill in for the cops reporter who happens to be off for the night. And so she starts stumbling across stories that the other reporters miss. She just happens to see stuff, but she's a beginner. So she drags her dad out of his cocoon and says, "Help me." And together they solve the things that they start seeing going on around town and figuring out what's really happening.
Would you like it if your daughter had I can't rule it out yet, she's too young, but would you like it if your daughter followed you into your chosen profession?
I've advised against it.
And why? It's such a gross industry.
I don't know if I should tell you this, but she said to me, "Don't worry, Dad, I don't want to be broken out of hope my whole life." I said, hello, I'm here, I can hear you. She said, well,
I'm in the room.
The profession is problematic. They're going through challenges now, and that's certainly true.
I have to make sure my daughter doesn't hear this either. I don't.
It's the way it goes. You know, yeah. Journalism's a funny world. But no, I want her to try other things.
But it's interesting, though, that you did start this so many years ago, and you know, writing about Charlie being the kind of the old timer in the newsroom, sort of, you know, the wizened old guy. You know, everyone knows. You know, they think they know what he's going to do. They think he knows what he's going to say. And he's surrounded by the minimum wage people who are kind of filling in all around him. And it's kind of become that in a lot of newsrooms now.
Some newsrooms, I'm happy to say, not so much at the Palm Beach Post. We have fewer people, but a lot of the ones that we have are really extraordinarily experienced, and so it's a bit of an inspiration. And I wasn't Charlie when I wrote the thing, and I'm not Charlie now. He's at a different stage in his life than I am, but it's something that I can imagine, because I've seen a lot of reporters take the buyouts and, you know, get to the stage in their careers where the newspapers put them in a spot because it needs somebody to fill the spot, or they, you know, they don't need them somewhere else. And you know, I've seen people sidelined. And the interesting thing about the book is that as Charlie's editors are messing with him, he's really messing with them in ways that they don't realize. The book kind of gets at that in fun ways.
The book seems to be about the 5 W's and the 1 S. A lot of people have commented, I think, on the S in the book, which is the stench of Miami.
Yeah, it's funny how that grips people. But, you know, again, it's me trying to make the reader feel and sense what, you know, what it's all about. And a lot of the back streets, you know, there are smells to walking on the city. New York too, you know, every place has its smell, its look, its touch. You know, Miami is a gorgeous city as well, and there's that in the book too. So.
What's the term that you use in there for the people who when in the heat of the summer and the sewers underneath the city streets they heat up. And the stench comes off of them, and they call it what? Swoon over Miami?
Yes, swoon over Miami.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that's on the menu yet at Denny's. I know they have moon over Miami, but
no. But there's a lot of truth to you know, the systems of the city that are underneath the street that are you know, all broken down, and so it's not unusual. Also, you're near the ocean, so occasionally you get that low tide smell anyway, now and then.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, do you you don't express a great deal of shall we just say respect for the political establishment and the business establishment, the real estate establishment in South Florida? I'm sure that's just taken to the nth degree. I'm sure in reality you feel that those folks are just fine, upstanding citizens and working hard for the general good. Is that correct?
I look at everybody as an individual. By and large, I think it's fair to say I wasn't impressed with the county commission in Miami. You know, they were up to a lot of stuff, and you know, I heard enough, and you know, what the price tag was for this one or for that one. I have a tremendous amount of respect for the business people. It takes a tremendous amount of intellect and drive and persistence to succeed. You know, in commercial real estate in particular. To know what you're doing, to make it happen. It's a highly competitive world. It's a lot of body contact. So it's not true that I don't respect them. I even people who are doing things that are, you know, what you might consider evil, I appreciate the cleverness in it. I have to say that. And you'll see that in this book. You know, some people who are bad people do great things, and some great people do some interesting and not so great things in the book. So.
And it takes a smart business person to control a stupid politician. I mean, we got to give him credit for that.
It can, yeah. Otherwise, it can come back to bite you. Sure.
And do you think, in general, in politics and business in general, there's a lot of collusion? Do you think there's a lot of that happening at the public tee?
Yes, I think you could call it collusion. Some people just think of it as the way to do business. You know, there's a lot of bureaucracy. It drives you crazy with impatience having to follow all the rules and regulations, and it's much easier to make friends with a politician. At some point, you know, making friends and working your Hunt goes a little bit farther, though. I did see some of that in Miami, and you never know when it's happening. Most of the time, you suspect it, and you can't prove it. So that's the beauty of fiction. You can create it.
Did it worry you at times not working in a factual basis, that you were, you know, creating a lot, you're creating a world, essentially, you're creating characters, and you were not necessarily bothered by the rigors of facts and fact-checking?
That was kind of liberating. It wasn't, I don't need to worry about facts. I need to make sure that the techniques that they're using are real, or at least possible. That's the whole fun of it. You know, it's kind of like one of the things that I used to think about as I was writing this was, when I used to tell my kids stories at bedtime, I would think of things that happened during the day and just completely put them together with other things and make stories out of them. That's what we all do as parents. What's the name of the Kaiser Soze? I mean, it's that kind of thing where you're looking at around the room, you see a poster, and you think, oh, I can incorporate that into the story. And that's all it is. It's fun, but also you're hoping at the same time that you're creating a sense of the feel and touch of how things really are and how they really work.
Kaiser Soze, that's right. Weren't you, Andy Garcia in... never mind.
No, Kevin Spacey. Maybe Andy Garcia, too. But
I think he was one of the characters, wasn't he?
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be.
Funny how that name keeps popping up here. So how different or difficult was the process of writing fiction versus journalism for you? Or were you able to go – I mean, because you were doing both in any given day while you were writing this. Were you able to go back easily back and forth?
Yeah, I was actually quite comfortable with it. Fiction is, you know, closer to my heart. So, and it started out with the people. You know, the first thing I did before I even tried to think out a plot was to imagine, well, first thinking of what I wanted to say, basically, but then who were the people going to be who can transmit this story? And so before writing a plot, I wrote a biography of 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 different characters, all of the characters who appear in the book. You know, I sketched out who they were, things that never appear in the book, but to know who they are and how they'll react. And so once you give life to them, then they act on their own in a way, and the plot goes with them. Yeah.
And what about, I mean, I think, again, journalism is a good training ground for this part. Did you do a lot of rewriting once you had finished the first draft?
A tremendous amount, you know, many times. Every chapter I went over and re-went over them. Shortened it, cut out a lot of stuff. It's, you know, I'm a reporter and I've been an editor for a lot of time too, so I'm used to cutting things out. You know, first, the whole technique to get the thing done, especially when you're doing it in bits and pieces, is spit it out, get it on the page, and then go back and redo it and polish it. And, you know, it's the same with any book.
Was there anyone particular that you trusted to read it after you, before you, you know, started showing it around?
It was hard. I gave it to a bunch of people to look at it. And, you know, it's funny, unless it's a real professional editor, the first thing they start looking at is typos, whereas what I was hoping people would look for were things like, you know, inconsistencies or this doesn't make sense or why don't you do this or that. I think at least my experience has been you always hope to have an editor who will really take charge and rework things. But in reality and in life, it's up to you. And so that's one of the ways in which my journalism experience helped. I was able to go it alone and for much of the way. And I wish I had paid attention to people who might have paid more attention to the typos, because I did end up with a bunch of those no matter how many times I rewrote it.
Listen, I've done enough books. I can tell you, no matter how many people's hands it goes through, it always winds up with typos, and there's some stupid error that you just go, oh, man, I can't believe that got by 16 people or 3
Bell
people.
Bell checker just doesn't catch half of it, you know.
No.
But, that, like I said, that's why it helps to have a little bit of experience as an editor, so I got most of that stuff. I was more concerned with making a good, fast-flowing story that was, you know, funny and you know, said something about what I wanted to say.
What is it about South Florida, do you think, that lends itself to these kind of books. I mean, you know, we talked about Carl Hiaasen, Rick Barry, even Elmore Leonard, who, you know, they can write a believable, whether it's a mystery or a sort of a journalistic thing or police procedural. But there's always this bizarre element that comes out of South Florida. And I mean, there's a writer who does it out of Tampa now as well.
It's really all over Florida. There's something about it. And I don't know. It's the heat. It's the humidity. there's a bit of the Wild West in there. There's a bit of an attitude of, you know, what's the worst that can happen? Let's go for it. There's a bit of, you know, Latin easy dealing or, you know, European easy dealing. It's all these cultures coming together and everybody trying to get away with something. And, you know, I'm not so sure that it doesn't happen elsewhere, maybe with a little different flavor to it. But, you know, I went up to Palm Beach County after being in Miami, and everybody up in Palm Beach County makes fun of Miami as being so corrupt, you know. And then one by one, a whole bunch of officials in Palm Beach County were ending up in jail. Just a good old boy kind of corruption instead of, you know, a young nouveau riche kind of corruption, you know. There's a lot of money flowing around in government, and a lot of people hold the purse strings, and so that's always, you know, you're always going to see stuff. But why it's particularly crazy, you know, I can only think people have been out in the sun too long down here.
Well, Palm Beach officials or Palm Beach business people, whatever case may be, them pointing at Miami and making fun of them is truly the you know, pot calling the kettle black. I mean, it's just, you know, hello, hanging chads, anyone?
Exactly. You know, it, like I said, it happens everywhere, but it is a fact of life up in the rest of Florida that people kind of look down their nose at Miami, and some of it's just out-and-out racism. It's what it amounts to. In Miami, it's sometimes the sheer the ambition of the crooks is what's so admirable. I don't know how else to say it. I admire that when I see them going to such great lengths and to do such things that seem so obvious that you and I would never do it because you know you'd get caught, and yet.
Well, what writers, I mean, going into this project, were there any particular writers that, you know, you thought about or you wanted to emulate or whose work you'd like, you know, to be sitting next to on a bookshelf one day?
I, of course, like the humor of Carl Hiaasen, who doesn't. It was important to me to have something that was also meaningful. Not that Carl Hiaasen doesn't have meaning in his books, but I, you know, so I could reach back to somebody like a Hemingway and say, short sentences, it can really bring tears to your eyes or make you see something that you didn't see before. So it was those kinds of all different elements, you know. And I got to say, every little word twist and game that I play with, maybe it's something that I learned from reading Shakespeare as an English major in college. You know, I don't lay claim to having any similarities to any of those folks, but you learn something from everybody along the way, obviously.
Interesting. So you've done the one book. Is there more dirt in your future? I mean, is there something else? Where are you going with this?
There is. I've already written a first draft of the second one, although, like anything else, I'm not happy with it. So I'll be working on it, and I have the idea for the third one. It is funny. I heard some movie producer or director on the radio a few weeks ago saying something like, you know, it always, you know, when we do these movies, they always suck, and our job is to take the suck out of them. So I've got a second book all done, but it's not done. So that's what I got to do.
So will that be the continuing adventures of Charlie and Madeline?
It will be. You know, I don't want to give too much away, but in this first book, you know, Charlie and Madeline, his daughter, you know, they do their investigative journalism and they pretty much figure out what's going on. And my theme of
you just gave away the ending. I told you I wasn't going to do that. Come on, no spoilers.
They pretty much figure out what's going on. The second book kind of happens a couple of years later. And, it turns out that after they were the big heroes, they got kind of snowed, or they got kind of, you know, shown in a darker light. People didn't like the way that they had gone about things, and so they ended up almost in exile, or at least Charlie did. And so the book is more about fighting back from, fighting back from being in and then being out and working their way back up into the public's good graces while actually making more of an effort to do what they feel is right. So it's kind of interesting because the first book ends with them being heroes, and the second book, oh, it didn't actually work out that well after all, did it? So.
See, and I kind of thought that in the second book it'd be a little different, that maybe Madeline found out that she wasn't actually Charlie's daughter, that she was actually Andy Garcia's daughter.
could be. And by the way, in the second book, Charlie's son appears.
Oh, he has a son.
Yeah.
Gee, is he a teenage boy?
well, we'll find out.
Yeah, okay.
Just a little bit of time travel again. Nobody is who exactly they are, but...
Okay. Are you ever going to work me into one of these? I'd like to be blurred as a character.
You didn't recognize yourself in that character that got thrown in jail in this book?
No, I did not. I do not read the end of the books before I interview someone who's written a novel. So just, you know.
I was trying not to say anything.
Yeah, I know.
But there's a bearded demon in there.
Okay. All right, that's the end of your interview. Folks, you can find my friend Tony Duras' first novel, Dirt, in great ebook stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. And let's just be clear, Tony, it's available on the Kindle. It's available on the Nook, right? It's available in the Apple bookstore.
That's correct, all those things.
All those places you can find it, and we expect pretty soon you'll be able to order it in print as well as a paperback. So, you know, if you're not an ebook person, come back soon. It'll be available in print. You can have a paperback copy. And what about, you have a website for the book, I believe?
TonyDuras.com. How can you forget that?
I just wanted you to say it. And what about, are you on Twitter or Facebook or any other social media?
I am on Twitter, TonyDuras at PBP, as in Palm Beach Post. And there's Tumblr and all kinds of things. Just, you can Google me and find out all kinds of stuff about the book and about what I've been up to.
All right. Well, and folks, remember, if you've been in Mr. Media before, you know that if you're watching this on MrMedia.com, somewhere below Tony there, not too far below, but, you know, like around just below what you can see here, should be a cover of the book. You can click on that, order it instantly via ebook. Yes, take your hands away from your pendulous breast, Tony. So you can click on it and have it instantly downloaded to your e-reader, or if by the time you see this, it might be available print on demand. You can order the paperback, and Amazon will deliver to you via drone in 30 minutes less, or it's free. Tony, my friend, always a pleasure to see you, and thank you so much for being a guest today on Mr. Media.
Thank you, Mr. Media.
The Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk, and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. Hey, these are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot.
And just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
The system is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights. Just a Minute with Joe Ardinger.
Like most people living in California, I'm deluding myself that I have the flu. But we all know it's really radiation from Fukushima. Or just the flu.
To hear the rest of this minute, to sample Joe's other minutes, and to subscribe to his newest ones, visit RealmNetwork.com. That's RELMNetwork.com. Just a Minute with Joe Ardinger, another great Realm Network production. Wednesday afternoons, right here on the Realm Network.
The preceding presentation was brought to you by the Realm Network.